I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Once upon a time, the gods were at war. It was the Olympians against the Titans. Zeus led the Olympians while Atlas commanded the Titans in battle. But when the Olympians won the war, Atlas was singled out for specific punishment. He was sentenced to carry the weight of the heavens on his shoulder. Well, that image of Atlas struggling to hold up the earth is a classic piece of sculpture. It's an image that's familiar to all of us, and, well, you might think that's about as relevant as the mythology was ever going to be. Thousands of years passed, and then an astronomer from Louisiana State University took his first close-up look at the planet on Atlas's shoulder. When Brad Schaefer applied his own understanding of the constellations, the sculpture suddenly became the key to helping resolve a debate that has bedeviled astronomers for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. This hour, a conversation about marking history by looking up. Have you ever thought of the stars as fact-checkers for key dates of civilization? When you use the stars to check events like the crucifixion of Christ or even Nat Turner's slave rebellion, does that change our sense of history and mythology? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brad Schaefer teaches astronomy at Louisiana State University, and he's joining us from studio in Baton Rouge. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Dick.
It's good to have you here. I want a bit of help before we start on this star chart, and that is, I kept coming across references to a feud or a dispute between these two ancient astronomers, Hipparchus and Ptolemy. What do I need to know about those two?
Sure. Hipparchus and Ptolemy are some of the greatest astronomers of antiquity, and we largely don't have much from Hipparchus. He left only one of his early works, whereas Ptolemy, several centuries later, wrote a book which is called the Almagest, which, well, in translation means the greatest, and indeed it, well, certainly for astronomy, was the greatest book. It really wasn't superseded till Copernicus came around. And, however, around about the time of Tycho Brahe in the 1500s, Tycho raised the question, how much of the, for example, the Almagest data was actually taken from, well, Hipparchus. And this general idea of this question where you might have, well, some perhaps substantial fractions of the Almagest being taken from Hipparchus and, well, earlier people, basically, this is a claim of fraud because Ptolemy never really says that he did this. So you have a big question here.
Was Ptolemy a plagiarist? Had he taken some of Hipparchus's understandings of the star and included them in his own writing, in his own Almagest? Was that the question then?
That's right. You put it perhaps a little too crudely, but yes, was he a plagiarist? A couple decades ago, there was a book titled The Crimes of Claudius Ptolemaeus. And this feud has been going on ever since the time of Tycho. And actually, in the last few decades, it's gotten more and more vociferous, and people have been arguing back and forth in many different forums, rather with strong emotions going on.
All right, so into this debate comes Brad Schaefer on vacation in Naples.
Well, it was vacation, but I would say that one had chosen to go to Naples for a purpose. The point was that the oldest depiction of the old Greek constellations was on this atlas, this statue. It's about a 6 foot tall statue, a 7 foot tall statue made of marble depicting the Titan Atlas, holding not a planet on his shoulder, but actually a depiction of the sky. And on this, it shows, well, actually, all of the old, or most of the old Greek constellations in rather beautiful detail.
Now, let me stop you there for half a second, because I went to the web and found a photograph of this globe on the fellow's shoulder. And in fact, I think we have that on our webpage right now. So if people are curious about what we're talking about, you can find us at theconnection.org. But Brad, it's this globe that's covered with pictures of, well, what am I looking at? An animal, a sheep, fish, people, maybe a ship over his right eye. Not what I would have called constellations. I thought I'd see little stars marked there.
Well, they are the depictions, the figures from the constellations. So, for example, there's a picture of Aries the ram with his characteristic head looking back over his shoulder.
Right,
and right below it is another well-known constellation, and off to one side from it is the two fishes connected by the rope. And the positions of these figures is well-known. For example, from Ptolemy's Almagest, we know what star each one of the positions in the constellation correspond to. For example, they show the Gemini, and both of the heads of the Gemini are depicted, depictions which show the place of two very well-known stars, Castor and Pollux, mm-hmm. named for the two Gemini. So we can actually take these pictures, and we can realize the positions that they're the stars that they're meant to record in those positions. And actually, a key piece of argument here is that the positions of the constellations, for example, the heads of the Gemini, are actually very precisely placed on the globe. So, in our parlance, that would be, it looks like they were positioned with an accuracy of better than about, 2 degrees. That's 4 diameters of the moon, which is actually pretty good for an old sculptor, which was copied once again. So we know that since they were placed so accurately that they had to have been placed there by, some sort of a star catalog, because the typical verbal descriptions of the time are much too imprecise.
So here you are in the National Archaeological Museum in Naples looking at this globe that's on Atlas's shoulder and marking where each of these carved relief figures are on the globe and thinking, hey, this is looking fairly precise. When did you think that there was really going to be something to this?
Well, actually, it was before I went there, because I knew in advance that it looked fairly precise. The trouble was, all the published pictures were, you didn't know how close the camera was to the globe. And and clearly the curators would not allow me to go clambering over the globe with my tape measures. So the solution was to take photographs from known distances. And it turns out you have to take them from known distances if you're to do the measurements and deduce the positions correctly. So that's why I had to go to Naples. And I was heading to the Mediterranean anyway to see last year's Transit of Venus, a beautiful effect. And so I used that opportunity to get to Naples to take the photographs, so I did not have to clamber over the globe.
Now, there's more on this globe. There are the lines of longitude and latitude. Was it enough for you to go back to your office in Baton Rouge and say, right, now I've got all these photographs, let's see what I can do with it?
Exactly. Well, that is what happened. And before going into this, I really didn't know what I was after here. For example, in this Ptolemy-Hipparchus dispute, I'm, kind of a neutral. I am just someone who goes out there and, tries to answer what questions I can. And this is a question that I knew I could answer, of trying to get the date of the position of these constellations. Because what you have is Hipparchus, one of Hipparchus's great discoveries, one of the reasons why he's one of the greatest in ancient times, is he realized that the position of the pole star moves across the sky. In fact, all the constellations kind of slip and slide around. And so what this means is that the constellations up in the sky are kind of like big hour hands, very slow-moving hour hands. But where a constellation is with respect to, we'd call it the collier, but it's kind of like a longitude of Greenwich on the sky, where these are with respect to it are like an hour hand. They tell you the time. So by looking at the position of the constellations and the stars they represent and where they are on the sky, you can read off the time.
So
that's what I was doing.
See, in the summertime, when I look up at the stars, I can always find the Big Dipper, and I can always find the North Star and some of the real sort of idiot stars that those of us who aren't trained in this look for. Are you saying that the places of these change enough each year that by looking at this sculpture, you were able to actually figure out the year when they were all marked?
Exactly. They change enough in a given year that astronomers at very precise telescopes have to worry about it. But for the average people out in the backyard, it would be fairer to say that they change over the centuries.
Right.
But if you have positions of many objects from around the entirety of the globe that's being held on the Atlas's shoulders, you can beat down the error bars, in effect, and come up with a fairly accurate date. In fact, that's one of the things I was doing, is using a precise analysis, a chi-squared analysis, which will it turns out, the accuracy of the date which I can determine is plus or minus 55 years, which is pretty good. And the date I came up with was 125 BC. And the reason why that's important, and once I came up with that value, that's when I knew what the answer was. The reason is there have been many people that have been proposed as being the ultimate source for the constellation figures on the Farnese Atlas. Ptolemy was one person, Aratus and Eudoxus from earlier Greek times, and a variety of such people have been suggested. By the way, no one ever actually suggested in any serious sense Hipparchus. But between these various alternatives, you could immediately reject Ptolemy because he was a couple centuries too late. You could immediately reject Aratus and Eudoxus because they were a couple centuries too early. So you could eliminate all the competitors to Hipparchus being the source for the positions of these constellations on the globe.
The Lost Star Catalog of Hipparchus. I love this story. 1-800-423-8255. Brad Schaefer is with us. Connection listeners, we're going to take a look at different parts of history and ask you to join our conversation. Can you read or redefine or be more precise about history by understanding what's going on in the sky? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Brad Schaefer is with us this hour. He's a professor of physics at Louisiana State University at the specialty in astronomy and astrophysics. And this hour we're talking about historical astronomy, what it is that people were watching 2,000 years ago and what it is that people are watching today and what we can learn about what's happened to us in the intervening time by making that kind of cross-reference check. We're at 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us. And just one more note, if you're interested in taking a look at the statue of Atlas called the Farnese Atlas, it's on the cover of our webpage. We're at theconnection.org. I want to, if I can, go to something that will be, Brad, a little bit more familiar to most of us, and that is Nat Turner's Slave Revolt. In one of the stories that I read about your historical tracking, that was mentioned as something where we can actually go back and learn a little bit more. What do we have to learn about Nat Turner? Where are we now? In the 1830s sometime, is that right?
Yes, we know Nat Turner best as being the leader of a slave revolt in Virginia. It was very short and did not last long and was not effective. However, it provides an illustration, actually, of, well, one of many ways at which astronomy can touch, well, both the broad sweeps of history and real everyday lives. In the case of Nat Turner, he was a Negro who was a preacher. He was one of the few that actually could read. He read the Bible. He was known locally by the people as the prophet. And one day, he happened to have a total solar eclipse that passed over him. This is in 1831. And this provided for him the perfect imagery of a black angel struggling with a white angel in the heavens above. And one would have a hard time seeing a better symbolism for that. And he then took this as being a sign from heavens that he should prosecute his slave revolt. And so this is just one example of how the heavens above aren't quite as remote as they often might appear to be.
Now, you can go back as an astronomer and check the, well, right down to the day, I suppose, of that particular eclipse, right?
Yes, indeed. And it did happen, as would surprise no one.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from East Aurora, New York. Alan's joining us. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I love your show. Many people are trying to determine the birth date of Christ based upon star visualization. But taking your perceived data here, I'd like to know if we could add 33 years to a assumed date of 6 BC for the birth of Christ. could we verify the lunar calendar holiday of Passover falling within a day of the week which would allow Easter to fall on Sunday? Do you understand what I'm saying?
It sounds like you're a lot farther ahead than me on this,
okay.
Alan. No. I'm going to ask Brad to jump in here. I think you're doing a good job of raising questions.
Sure. You're addressing two issues here, actually. One of which, and they're a little bit coupled, but largely independent. For the Star of Bethlehem, which is the question of the birth of Christ, I would actually refer to an epical revolutionary work by Michael Molnar, which has taken the history community by storm for trying to describe what for realizing what the Star of Bethlehem actually was. In the past, me and other people have pointed out that the Star of Bethlehem could have been any of a number of astronomical spectaculars up in the sky. Supernova, comets, Halley's Comet. There are many different things that have been proposed. Astronomers are very good at figuring out what the ancient skies looked like. However, Molnar's point was that all these astronomical explanations and spectaculars have to be wrong. The reason is that... in effect, the only people that matter for the Star of Bethlehem are the Magi, and the Magi were not astronomers. They were astrologers, and for astrologers, they have no place on their horoscopes to put a supernova. They never look up to see a comet, and there's no interpretation in their astrology or horoscopes for conjunctions. So we know that all of these old astronomical spectaculars are just non-starters. In fact, Molnar... the obvious conclusion is he tells us what the Star of Bethlehem had to have been. It was a horoscope. That's the only thing that would have told Persian astrologers about the birth of a very great king in Judea.
So there was no one light in the sky? Is that Michael's conclusion then, Brad?
Michael Molnar's conclusion is that you have these... a particular configuration of planets, which according to the astrology of the day, would have been the sign of the birth of a very great king in Judea. He has found, searching over a long period of time, he's found one particular unique day, and that was indeed in 6 BC, which is quite about right, because we know Herod died in 4 BC. We know that from Josephus telling about a lunar eclipse that happened at Herod's death.
Could I jump in here? If you take that 6 BC figure, now I want you to move forward 33 years.
Yes.
And picture the sky that was in place in 27 AD. Now, we know that Jesus rose on Sunday. That's something that we assume because of the way the Christians observed Sundays to the future of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we follow back that Passover would have had to fallen on Wednesday or Thursday. Do you understand,
Brad? How precise can you be, Brad?
Well, we actually can be fairly precise on the questions of the Jewish calendar of the time. And my particular work has been relating to understanding the days of the visibility of the thin crescent moon, which is what starts the, for example, the Jewish lunar month of Nisan. The traditional way of phrasing the problem goes as follows. The crucifixion had to have happened on a Friday, and I'll get back to that in a moment if you want.
Okay.
The crucifixion had to have happened on a Friday, somewhere during the reign of Pontius Pilate, which I think was 26 to 36 AD, and it had to have happened on either the 14th or the 15th of the Jewish lunar month of Nisan. Now, my particular, one of the things I can do very well is calculate the days of, the first day of the month, which depends. It's actually a rather hard problem of trying to figure out the thin crescent visibility, which is the first day, much like the modern Islamic people do. And so I can calculate those dates better than people have in the past. However, my conclusions have come up with the same answer, even though I have a better way of calculating it. And so to that problem I just phrased you, you come up, there are only two dates on which, in the reign of Pontius Pilate, in which the 14th or the 15th of the Jewish lunar month of Nisan was on a Friday, and those two dates happen to be in 33 AD and in the year 30 AD. So the usual conclusion, which I would agree with, given that statement of the problem, is that the crucifixion was in 30 or 33 AD, and there's no real way to tie break between the two.
You said you had a better way of calculating the moment when the thin crescent moon appears. What is that? Is it mathematical, or what is it?
Oh, well, very much so. Largely, I'm just the first person who has gone through, I've actually spent a large amount of time on this, gone through and treated the lunar crescent visibility problem as a modern astrophysics problem, where one goes out and models the light transmission and the refraction through the air. And there are well-known equations that are rather complex for determining the brightness of the moon as a function of everything. And one can also figure out the brightness of the sky. And from physiology papers, one can figure out what it takes for the moon to be visible. And you can move this through any given night and see whether the moon will be visible. I'm modeling the physical processes. But like modern scientists, not only do I have a model where I can do this, but hey, I've also gone off and collected large amounts of real data for comparison with the model. And that, of course, you have to, well, my model might or might not be good, but the data will tell you whether the model is or is not good. And within the quoted error bars, I'm very fortunate because I don't have any adjustable parameters. I find that the model does agree well with the large database of observations collected by me and others. So yes, I actually do have an algorithm which can, much better than anyone else, tell you when the thin crescent moon is visible and when one Nisan is and when one Ramadan is.
Yeah, the part that I was going to ask you is if you ever run into disagreement with the people who do this without using the same kinds of tools, because as you quite rightly point out, Brad, it's really, really important to some people to know precisely when the moon first appears. And without a scientist or an astrophysicist to help us, then it's going to be an imam or a mullah or someone who's up there keeping an eye on the sky. And is there a time when the precision of science gets in the way of what's a much more sort of mythological exercise?
Well, I have to be careful here because I believe that modern Islamic practice is to be based entirely on observations. So I or anyone could come up with claims as to when they think the crescent moon should become visible,
right.
but that's not so relevant. So I don't think that my work is directly applicable, certainly not post facto or deciding any disputes between people. And there's always questions. In cases where the moon is only marginally visible, it's often very easy for people to make mistakes, or the cloudiness and haziness conditions might be different from one site to the other. Or there are many different little loose ends in there which can make for, well, complications in the real world.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about using the very best of science to figure out what's going on up there and comparing that against observations made on Earth by people who were paying a lot more attention to those things in years past and what it teaches us about history. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Newton, Massachusetts for our next call, and Dietrich's with us. Hi, Dietrich.
Hi, this is Dietrich Pessin from Newton, and I use these sky as a source of study, and I look back in history and see how the sky is related to current times and how the stories are correlated, and using the position of the planets in the signs, and using the eclipses, using the distances from the planets, etc. And there's a period in 1898, just prior to that, actually, where things began to look as if they were, very closely aligned with the storylines that we had been experiencing here in the year 2000, when we had the election that was undecided and needed to go to the Supreme Court. There was an election back in the 1890s between Harrison and Cleveland that...
Are you saying that what was going on in the sky at the time of that contested election is very similar to what was going on in the sky in the year 2000?
Precisely.
That just chance? Or are you saying there's more to it than that, Dietrich?
Much more to it than that, because there are cycles there are cycles of eclipses, of which I've written a book about. There's cycles of eclipses and lunar patterns that fall along with the Metonic cycle, for instance, and the Saros cycle, both of which will create these repeats, and then couple that with major outer planetary alignment.
Let me, if I can, turn to Brad on this, because in part, when you enter this world of mythology and astrology and mix that with the modern science of astronomy, those fields, Brad, that I'd always managed to kind of keep separate in my mind start to get muddied together. I don't know if this is causes a difficulty for you in the kind of work that you do.
Well, you have to be a little careful here. Astrology is a predictive science, fails at best. But astrology as a historical force is something that must be remembered. When you're looking back at old astrology, it was an important force for people way back when, right or wrong. And so you have to recall about this. Now, the issue about the skies in 1898 with the skies over the last few years, I think that is probably not a I know of no such connection. And one always has to be rather careful here, because round about the same time as this last election, we also had a variety of planetary conjunctions, which people were going around claiming the end of the world would be here and things like that. And I think
that was
Democrats,
I think.
well, there might be other reasons for it, but people were claiming it was due to the various planetary alignments. And I think I now have personally lived through about six such end of the worlds from things like planetary conjunctions. Who knows? It might happen someday, but I've lived through six of them. So I think we have to look elsewhere than than in the skies for current political problems.
Although what's interesting here, and I'm trying to make sense of this myself, is that you as a scientist can use the astrological observations made in years past as a way of going back and figuring out the astronomy and the time and the place and the location of events. Did I get that right?
Yes, very much like what Mike Molnar did for the Star of Bethlehem, a work I very much admire.
And so when you say the Star of Bethlehem is 6 years before the date that Christ is thought to have been born, what do you do with that? I mean, are you saying that, hey, you know what? We're pretty close to what, you know, the Bible and the old texts have told us? Or are there people who go, well, just, you know, I mean, you know, you can't change history. The date was the date.
Right. Well, for the date not being zero, or for the date of Mike Molnar's Star of Bethlehem not being zero, well, that's simply attributable back to an error made by, I think it was Dio Cassius, someone who tried setting the date back in, I think it was the 4th century AD. So that sort of a difference really doesn't mean much. But you ask a higher level question here as to whether the setting of the date of the Star of Bethlehem, which I believe actually has been done, I believe Molnar has come out with that date quite confidently. But you then have the question what the implication of that date is. And you kind of epitomize the two extremes that one could imagine. And I think that the mere setting of the date for the star has not decided on any of the higher issues, ranging even from the divinity of Christ to the validity of things in the Bible historically. What you have here is the issues that are being talked about, for example, in dating the crucifixion or in dating the Star of Bethlehem, those really don't impact on issues of faith. There are other much better, stronger reasons for that than arguments based on dates.
Connection listeners, if we are taking a look at what we know of what was in the sky in times past, what can we learn about the history and what happens when the stars tell us that something's slightly off? Does it really change it for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a little bit of historical astronomy with Brad Schaefer, Associate Professor of Physics at Louisiana State University, and a man who is given credit for discovering the lost star catalog of Hipparchus, parked there on the right shoulder of the statue of Atlas, the National Archaeological Museum in Naples, Italy. 1-800-423-8255. Have we stopped looking up? Does nobody pay any attention to what's going on up there? You look back in the history books, and you find that people chose the time and marked the time, marked the place, marked the event by what was going on in the heavens. I'm wondering whether or not we look up as much as we used to or should anymore. Go ahead, Brad.
I don't think we do look up as much as we used to and maybe as much as we should because, well, largely with light pollution and television, people aren't outside. They aren't around campfires or, well, such, where there's nothing else to do but to look up and make stories about the constellations in the heavens.
But let me be a cynic here. I mean, the person sitting by the campfire can invest $200 in something called a little GPS toy, which tells them exactly where they are on the planet, give or take a meter or two. But it doesn't mean that what's going on up there is any less important. It just means people don't have to look up anymore. And I'm wondering what's being missed.
What's being missed is beauty and a sense of place in the universe.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Newton, Massachusetts for our next call. Jim's with us. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I'm just as an aside, I'm outside at the moment, and there's actually only one star in the sky right now.
That's the sun, right?
That's the sun. But I wanted to go back and ask
the test.
So it's still there. Some more about Atlas. And I was wondering, is the copies of the, or the placement of the constellations, is that... that's done from data rather than like just copying down the sky on the statue?
Well, that was the point there of finding that the positions of the constellations were so accurately placed on the globe being carried by the atlas that you could not do that, for example, by the artist just kind of slapping down a constellation or even working from some of the verbal descriptions which existed at the time, for example, by Aratus. So the only way you really could go getting that accuracy of the placement is if you used a star catalog, something where you've actually gone out and measured positions and places of things.
Yeah,
that's actually one of the arguments for Hipparchus is because there are very few ancient star catalogs. In fact, before Ptolemy, there was one old star catalog, and that was the lost star catalog of Hipparchus. So if you find an accuracy that requires it to come from a star catalog, and it has to come from around 125 BC, there's only one possible conclusion, that this indeed is, well, one of the greatest pieces of ancient Greek science, and it has indeed been lost to us.
Okay, then I'm wondering, how did the accuracy get to be that good that long ago?
We know from the accuracy of the extant catalog of Ptolemy that the accuracy is better than 1 degree. They actually had some fairly good equipment which they can use to measure the positions of the stars at the time. We know that they do have that, and people in modern times have been able to reproduce this sort of accuracy. So the ancients actually were able to get to accuracies of roughly 1 degree, which is what we see on the globe.
So I have just one more question about this globe on Atlas's shoulder. And you mentioned Ares the ram is one of the figures on there. On the size, on the globe, he's about the size of Australia. You know, if we think about the continents. So where on the ram do we say, huh, there's the star? Is it like right at the tip of the nose? Or do you understand my question?
Sure. The question is, how can I identify a particular star with a particular place on, well, for example, the ram?
And be that precise, yeah.
And be that precise. Well, there are kind of two answers. One answer is simply that there are very strong identifications from the Greek times of what star corresponds to what figure. For example, the extreme position on the horn of the ram, which on the picture of the Farnese Atlas you can see is touching, well, what would be the equivalent to the longitude of Greenwich, zero longitude on the sky, that position happens to correspond to the star Gamma Arietis. So this is well known. And so I have gone through and made a variety of other very specific identifications between parts on the constellations and in particular stars in the sky that we know the identification is certain. So that's part of the one answer. The second answer is actually more of an empirical one. If, for example, I had made my assignments greatly wrong, then the accuracy at which I would have found would have been much worse than what I actually did find. So the only way I could have found accuracy of better than 2 degrees or so is if my identifications of parts of these constellation figures with particular stars happen to have an accuracy of, well, better than 2 degrees.
Now, this is being published, I think, next month in the Journal of, help me with that.
A Journal for the History of Astronomy. It's the premier journal of history of astronomy, published in England.
Does it end the argument between Ptolemy and Hipparchus, or is part of that going to keep going?
I'm sure it will keep going. The reason is the various protagonists in the dispute are, let's say, solidly entrenched, and there will always be some way to argue back and forth. You also have to be careful. All I've done here in particular is identified this atlas. The source of the constellations on this atlas is coming from Hipparchus's Lost Star Catalog. And that doesn't decide of how much of Ptolemy's Almagest is indeed, plagiarized, to use too strong a word, or maybe not too strong a word if you go with some people. However, I believe that the positions on this on the Farnese Atlas can be used to help solve the dispute, and I have not done this. This will be a rather large project that of course, all the sides would have to agree upon, which they might well not be able to. But the idea is as follows. We know that this Farnese Atlas comes from Hipparchus' star catalog. And we know that, what we have in hand here is where Ptolemy's star catalog came from. That's the question. Now, if we find that, for example, there are some characteristic errors, which we know of in Ptolemy's star catalog, if those are repeated on the Farnese Atlas, then we'd have a fairly clear lineage that Ptolemy's star catalog came from Hipparchus' star catalog, and that would certainly support the side of the people that say it was largely lifted from Hipparchus. Or maybe we might not find it. I don't know the answer to that yet. I think there we have to stay tuned.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Brad Schaefer is my guest. He takes a look at the stars from a historical perspective and what they teach us about what was going on times in the in our past and in the long-distance past. Brad, I wanted to move ahead to something that you're working on right now. I gather you or your department or you and colleagues have just been set to work on 150 years of sunspot records. Is that accurate?
Yes, I have a grant from the National Science Foundation to look over since 1849, the records of sunspots. And it's actually a fairly technical point here, which I'm looking over. That is, I believe that there is a particular problem with the Zurich sunspot counts, which have been widely used for questions of how active our sun is, and hence for sun-Earth connections. And I believe that there is actually a relatively small but perhaps important error in those old sunspot counts. I don't think anyone should rush out and throw away all the old work, but what I'm hoping to do is to use these large numbers of observations from sunspot observers around the world to correct this error and to come up with an improved sunspot count, which will hopefully make for better debate on issues, for example, of sun-Earth connections.
Does that include something like global warming? Would it bring us any closer to an understanding of what kind of change we've seen over the past 150 years?
Well, the sun clearly does affect, small changes in the sun clearly do affect global climate here on Earth. However, the sun cannot account for the rapid expansion or the rapid heating of the climate since roughly 1970 or so. If nothing else, the sun's been getting less active since then. So there's no connection there. Largely, I think the science of the field has long moved past the question of whether the sun is causing the current exponential global warming here on Earth. It clearly cannot be. That has to be due to man-made global greenhouse gases. So there are other issues, though, which this sunspot analysis can go addressing. But for global warming, the science community is very unanimous that the last 20, 30 years of exponential warming is due to man.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for a call from Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. How are you this morning?
You're a long, long way away. Can you get close to your telephone?
Yes, I took it off speaker. Sorry. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
What I was going to ask your guest is, were there any particular alignments or constellations, alignments of the planet or constellations in the sky at the time of John Paul II's death that people might look back on and say, oh, this was a sign? Or
no.
Do you think we're past those type of things?
Humanity is always looking for signs, and the sky is often a fertile source for looking at signs. For the case of the death of John Paul II, I am fairly confident that there's nothing much up there which one could point to. The constellation or the planets are pretty well evenly distributed around the constellations. There was an eclipse of the sun several days ago, visible from the South Pacific and the northern part of South America. But I suspect that no one would attribute that to being a cause and effect. The skies are beautiful. The skies are always doing something that, in retrospect, you could point to. But in the last week or two, there's been nothing that would be terribly exceptional that one could claim was a sign.
I wonder, though, if in your own work, looking back, you find some alignment, some event in the sky, and just sort of mark it on the calendar and check and see what was going on in the Earth at that time. I'm only asking the question because it's really quite common for people to want to find larger explanations for big events here on Earth that would have a connection or a cause or some kind of link with what's going on beyond this Earth.
There is something very human about trying to find larger explanations, and at least colloquially, signs in the sky, humanity can't touch things in the sky. So if something happens in the sky, it can only be a sign from God or gods, whatever your beliefs are. And so it's an obvious place to try, is looking up.
1-800-423-8255 to Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Now, Bernard's with us. Hi, Bernard.
Hi. A book, a frustrating, wonderful book called Hamlet's Mill by a historian at MIT who knew everything and a woman in Germany.
Now, careful now. Brad studied in MIT. It may be a close friend.
No. He must have heard of it. But anyway, recently his notion was in part that much of mythology is actually an analog for astronomy. The stories work on two levels. And a few years ago, some people in England, and their name escapes me, published a book along those lines, which claimed to identify constellations with the characters in the Iliad, the notion being that on one level the Iliad was a way of memorizing the sky. And I wonder if he has any feelings about the validity of that book, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Bernard.
Sure. Bernard, you have wonders that many people have. There are a wide variety of claims, counterclaims. I get a book or a paper once a week or once a month on these sorts of things. Hamlet's Mill is certainly one of the better knowns of these claims, where you're trying to encode greater things into farmers' fields or into the Iliad or into myths around the world. Essentially, none of these have been persuasive, shall we say. I think the answer is that they are not taken seriously other than, I'll leave it at that.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. Where are we going next to Cape Cod, Massachusetts? Toby's with us. Hi, Toby.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I just had a quick question about the Hipparchus and the Atlas sculpture question. He was saying that your guest was saying, I'm enjoying the show greatly, your guest was saying that he dated the sculpture to plus or minus about 55 years. And he said that, you know, from that we can deduce that it probably was taken from the Hipparchus star catalog. I just wonder why he doesn't think it could have come from an earlier astronomer and passed down through the, you know, through the generations. He was saying that, well, it couldn't have been early, you know, these other guys, because they were a couple hundred years too early. But why couldn't it have been their work that, you know, was then used 200 years later for this sculpture?
That's a very good question. The reason is, suppose an astronomer, say, back in Assyria in 1130 BC, and I'll use that for point in a moment, happened to have observed the positions of the constellations, and these positions got passed down. If the sculptor who was making the statue was sculpting those positions from that Assyrian observer or whoever, then the positions that he would have recorded on the atlas would have been the positions of the constellations at the time the observations were made. So, but the actual positions of the constellations on the globe are from 125 BC. So it couldn't have been this old Assyrian observer. However, we do have examples of exactly something like that. In particular, the earliest written global description of the Greek constellations is from a runaway bestseller poem by the Greek poet Aratus, who is, I think, in the 3rd century BC. And he gives a lot of detailed descriptions about where things are in the sky and what rises when something else sets, and actually quite a lot of information. And one can play the same game of taking the verbal descriptions in Aratus and trying to date them. And you could also get a latitude. And indeed, the date I found for Aratus's lore comes from 1130 BC, plus or minus 80 years, okay? So indeed, Aratus is merely mentioning, repeating very old lore. Well, in particular, we know from history that we know that Aratus was actually just copying earlier work from Eudoxus, but even Eudoxus had to have been reporting work even 800 years older.
It's confusing, and you make it accessible. I thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Brad Schaefer is a professor of physics at Louisiana State University. And if you'd like a look at that fascinating globe on Atlas's shoulder, you can find it on our website. We are at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.